all the time. Our plan for the afternoon is to continue our trek through the hymns that Chautauqua has been singing since its founding in 1874. And this year, we will look at the years between 1925 and 1945 following World War I. Our first attention will be to this place, and then we will move through the decades that surround it with song and history. Chautauqua's hymns have been a core focus of strength and tradition, center points that have kept the community on track as the dance of life draws folks to and fro, to new ideas, to let go of some old ones, and to hold on for dear life to others. There is stability and there is dance. The foundational structures we value give us the context for the metaphorical dances that we do. We often sing about what grounds us, and sometimes we dare to dance while we sing, often in our souls more than in our feet as Protestants. So, with several of the traditional things to ground us, let's begin by shifting our attention to Jared to lead us to the one that has opened Sunday worship.
and there the Art Moderne style, Art Deco was made in 1968. The interior and exterior speak of two clearly different styles. Gothic elements for the exterior and Art Deco for the interior. Jared and others remember the original chandeliers and lights along the walls as having an industrial look of vertical light and tubing, similar to the style used by Frank Lloyd Wright in Johnson Wax Factory in Wisconsin. I'd like you to note, particularly on the way out, but now you can see the side windows, and then look at the other one on the way out, and also the small ones that go over the light us in the windows reflects the seasons of a Christian liturgical year. Green, purple, white, gold, and red. The filtered light changes with the weather. Sunny, cloudy, dark. Always with clear dominance of the greens of the surrounding woods. Because the windows were restored for the 2008 season, and the light they mediate is such a dominant feature of the space, we decided that the use of a PowerPoint was inappropriate. It would not only be lost, but would be too difficult to see. The dedication of the fellowship hall and the name stone over the door, look at that as you need to, but not until you get to the bottom of the stairs, please, took place in February 1931, before the sanctuary was completed. Mabel Powers, who some of you recognize because of the fire circle named for her at the moment, led an Indian ritual at the fireplace and the name stone, a gift from the pioneer class of the Chautauqua Literary and Scientific Circle, the first class in 1882, of which Hurlbut had been president, was unveiled. Other CLSC classes donated windows in the plaques are at the base of the windows. The dedication of the sanctuary was on August 31st, 1931, 1 year after Jesse Hurlbut had died at age 87. The organ was given by Mrs. Charles E. Welch, a member of her husband, who had been an institution trustee for 14 years. Other generous gifts came from folks with other denominational affiliations. One, a woman who had spent over 40 summers at the Athenaeum Hotel. A familiar hymn that had been part of the very first services of the Chautauqua Assembly was part of the dedication of the church. We'll sing that now.
Thank you.
pageantry on other topics have been used here since 1890 for telling the story of historical legends, but not for religious purposes. This was high risk. It was, however, the next step of creative development to accompany or follow the large group oratorial productions that his predecessor, Alfred Pollan, had introduced. Smith was known for his collection of over 1,000 costumes that made the pageantry of his programs come alive with color. Now, by adding drama to music and the word, an additional sensory source of learning became acceptable. Smith also created sacred song programs of multiple choirs drawn from all over the region. The 1920s continued to be in the web of hopes and fears following World War I. Americans and Chautauquans need to be reminded, at least, of the peace agenda, lest it be smothered by the continuing concerns about politics and dangers in Europe. In 1925, Oxford Smith addressed the subject of brutal war and fragile peace at a sacred song service using a program he prepared for both Chautauqua and the Federal Council of Churches of America entitled International Justice and Goodwill. Jared will work us through that.
Many of you know that stained glass windows in medieval era were designed to tell stories to people who did not know how to read or write, but they could sense from the pictures and the flow of the pictures in the glass of the buildings themselves what the stories were. Chautauqua was founded on education. It was the prototype for lifelong learning. And the sacred song services became an important part of that lifelong learning. Using the tools that were available to Chautauquans at the time who could read and write. These are a kind of stained glass window situation in music. This sacred song service that we're about to talk was actually done exactly 86 years ago tonight as part of the services on July the 19th in 1925. It is really very beautifully worked out, to my surprise, because this is my job here. In part to create sacred song services that sometimes try to do the same kinds of things, it would appear that the leaders of the sacred song service team at the time looked at what was going on in the world, especially after the war that was supposed to have ended all wars, and already the beginnings of some storm clouds on the horizon that would lead into the 1930s. In 1925, there was a kind of guarded rejoicing time, I guess would be the best way to put it. So this sacred song service was a mixture of music and of the spoken word with the pageantry added to it. I'm guessing that the man who had the trunks full of 1,000 costumes knew that he could do just about anything visually, but this is a very intriguing way to look at what was going on in worship. The service starts with something called Shepherds of the People. It's listed as a prologue. And it's full of the kind of imagery that today we consider kind of quaint and maybe post-Victorian. The leader said, "My sheep wandered through all the mountains, not far out on every high hill. Yes, my flock was scattered upon all the face of the earth, and no one did search or seek after him." Then the choir sang to a very obscure tune the words, "Upon the hills the wind is bleak and cold. The sweet young grasses wither on the old, and we, O Lord, have wandered far from thy fold, but evening brings us home." So the prologue of this plays exactly on what's happening around you at twilight time in this part of the summer, a summer evening on July the 19th of 1925. It goes on in that vein with the leader reading sentences and the choir responding, and always at the end of each verse, "At evening bring us home. At evening, bring us home. At evening, bring us home." It sounds like a gimmick when you read it, but when you realize and you put it in the context of what we do in sacred song services today, when we begin our services with "Day is dying in the west," and we end them with "Now the day is over," we are really doing the same thing. Evening, has brought us home. The first part of this is entitled The Desolations of War. This was still very fresh in people's minds. There were Chautauquans who had lost their lives in World War I. And the theme actually started with what's called the hate theme, and it's a little fragment from Mendelssohn's oratorio, St. Paul. And it's the part in the oratorio, which is like an opera done in church, where Mendelssohn portrays the stoning of Stephen. And so, stone him to death, the choir is singing, and the orchestra is playing, as people are pondering the desolations of war. Everybody says things like, we stretch out our hands, greedy, grasping, tyrannical, to possess the earth. Domination, power, glory, money, merchandise, luxury, these are the things we aim at. And the leader says, what we really gain is pest and famine, grudge, labor, the enslaved hate of men and women, ghosts, death, and dead, breathing ghosts that haunt our lives forever. So far, it's a pretty gloomy sacred psalm service, I think you could safely say. To the tune of Faith of Our Fathers, the whole congregation sings this. The tumult and the shouting dies, the captains and the kings depart. Still stands thine ancient sacrifice, a humble and a contrite heart. Lord God of hosts, be with us yet, lest we forget, lest we forget. And this alternates for six verses. They were big on verses. You think I subject you to a lot of verses these days? I think five is usually my upper limit. But this is six verses to the same thing. And that leads us into our day of memory. And this section is subtitled Requiem in No Man's Land. The leader says, O youth, foregone, foregoing, O dreams, unseen, unsought, God give you joy of knowing what life your death has brought. And the congregation responds, Bring flowers they loved, let trumpets sound and the feast be spread. We who must live salute you, who have found strength to die. And then a bugler plays taps. The unknown soldier, with Leonidas at Thermopylae, with Charles Martel at Tours, with Wellington at Waterloo and at Arlington. A tenor soloist sings the trumpeter, and we have a litany of remembrance. We give thee thanks, we beseech us to you to hear us, O Lord, and graciously hear us, O Christ. This leads us to part three, which Marley will take over.
I consider the
Lord's
mercy and shall be no sin, no pain, ideas of the social gospel began to be written into hymns, of our responsibility to make God's kingdom on earth more reality by our human engagement with the problems facing our fellow creatures. We began to notice other cultures, those in our midst, and those whose stories came to us from missionaries. While Christians were exhorted to take the gospel to all corners of the earth, the images of power and glory that were mixed in as a result of our national history sharply contrasted with the images of the life of Jesus as we learned from the New Testament. Shaler Matthews, head of the Department of Religious Work, seemed to represent an interesting mix of the two. But he was especially known for the work that he did in promoting the responsibility of the Christian community beyond just a focus on personal behavior to engage the problems of the greater world. While he was severely criticized by some who believed his thinking to be too progressive, he remained open to them because he knew that at base they shared the same core beliefs. He brought to Chautauqua chaplains and others in the world of religion who promoted an open mind for new ideas for a new generation. Mixed with our northern European bias in hymns were African spirituals that we learned particularly from the Jubilee singers from Fisk University. They had started coming to Chautauqua in the 1880s and returned in the 1920s. A black group always teaching us their heartfelt song, stories through song, missionaries of sorts to the white north. American Indian songs and folk songs from our Appalachian traditions appear in sacred song programs. We learned of mission work to establish home schools in the southern mountains to teach girls modern techniques and basic skills for good family leadership. The rough life in lumber camps on the northern borders of New York State was also a target of efforts to civilize the men with Christian-inspired behavior. We hadn't started listening yet. We knew what they needed. And some of the words we used to describe these others, savage, heathen, and primitive, are embarrassing to us now as we work at integrating our diverse population, but in fact, are part of our past. Chautauquans were also aware of the beauty of the setting here, even as new cottages were built and trees cut down. It was the evening that was celebrated from early on. The evening shadows as they fell on the lake and in the woods. In the morning, Chautauqua was awakened by the sun shining on this side of the lake. And we received the shadows of light in the evenings. This beauty became a singing tradition in Chautauqua. They were part of the center's tradition that held to the course as new ideas danced around them. Jared undoubtedly has the following words and notes permanently inscribed in his psyche for the time that he has been singing and playing this Chautauqua.
Softly Now, The Light of Day is a hymn that's been sung as part of our whole first night festivities every year since the beginning. And we do this year, well, as we've done recently, we do the fragment of the original Vesper service to begin the old first night process, which is our annual birthday party on the first Tuesday in August. I'm sure some people who come are scratching their heads as to why we plop this little bit of religiosity down in the middle of the balloons and the birthday cake and the children's parades. But it is a link back to our 1874 roots. So I would invite you to sing with me, please. It's on page 5 of your program. This bit of Softly Now the Light of Day, and join the long procession of people who have sung this since 1874.
Thank you.
procession into the amphitheater. It's not a planned procession. It's just something that happens at the close of the day as people make their way to the amphitheater to sing the bookends of our services, which have been in place largely since 1907 when the Massey organ was dedicated. That is to open the evening services with Day is Dying in the West and to close them with Now the Day is Over. In many hymnals where you still find it, and that's not every hymnal by any means, but places where you find it, the name of the tune for Day is Dying in the West is Chautauqua. So if people know nothing else about this place, they know they've seen that odd Indian word go by. And it's surprising where Day is Dying in the West and Now the Day is Over will pop up in the non-Chautauqua world. I know it's hard to believe there's a place beyond Chautauqua, but there really is. My Lutheran pastor, who came from a small town in West Virginia, originally said that when he was in the second grade, at the end of every school day, Monday through Friday, the children would put their books inside their desks. Remember those desks with the flip top? And they would clean everything off the top. They would put their heads down in their hands, and they would sing quietly, Day is Dying in the West. It worked for them at 2:30 in the afternoon on a weekday, and it works for us on Sunday night. I know that many of you know that, so we're going to skip directly to Now the Day is Over, which is the song that we sing at the end of the service, right before the playing of Chautauqua's Largo. I am very fond of saying that Largo is our holy grail here at Chautauqua. It is an obscure little fragment of a very obscure oratorio, which is an opera written for church by George Frederick Handel. The original words have to do with trees and shadows, so it does fit the twilight time. But here at Chautauqua, more than any place I know, Largo is the thing that closes the day for people. It helps make their Chautauqua experience complete no matter what else happens here. For many people, the trigger at the beginning of their Chautauqua journey is hearing Holy, Holy, Holy sung on Sunday morning. Sunday evening, collecting everybody back in the amphitheater to sing that is a remarkable experience. So I'll ask you to remain seated and join me in singing Now the Day is Over. Thank you.
give weekly organ concerts and often included works of American organists. The newly formed Chautauqua Opera Company also grew heavily on New York talent from the Metropolitan Opera and Juilliard School. When Albert Stessel became music director in 1929, he knew Chautauqua, and the decision was made for him to lead all aspects of the music program, the newly formed Chautauqua Symphony, the Opera Company, Music School, Chamber Music, and Sunday Music. American music was a strong agenda at the time. Having opera in English in Norton Hall was a major factor, but it was current in New York. And so whether organ or symphony, Chautauqua ears began to hear this new music in their concerts. Undoubtedly, this added to the self-awareness of Chautauquas to their American identity. Yet the news from and about Europe in the years following the end of World War I was so dominant that it caused Albert Stessel to say in 1925, and I quote, "America is arriving at nationalism at too communicative an age to develop a folk music idiom, in spite of a bit of Negroes, American Indians, or original Anglo-Saxons," unquote. So it was up to composers such as George Gershwin to infuse accepted forms with new ideas. 1925 was the year when Gershwin came to work on his concerto in F in this setting of fine musicians, especially tapping the talents of pianist Ernest Hutchison, the head of the music school and a faculty member at Juilliard School in New York. He sought advice for integrating his jazz ideas into a concerto structure. It was a deadline issue. The premiere was to be in a few months. We'll turn to Jared to expand.
George Gershwin came here really as a fugitive from the party circuit in New York. He and his brother Ira were enormously popular, not only for the concerts they did and the compositions they were commissioned to write, but they were wonderful storytellers, and they were both superb cooks. They lived in the same street in Beverly Hills where Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz lived. Jimmy Stewart and Gloria, his wife, were backdoor neighbors. It's called Roxbury Drive. It's a little cul-de-sac, and it feels a little bit like Chautauqua with grander houses. And they were very much at the center of the party scene. The problem for George Gershwin was he had this commission, as Marley said, with the deadline looming. And finally, somebody said, "You'll never get anything done if you stick around New York. You need to go to this obscure place called Chautauqua." And he said they have wonderful facilities there. They have instruments, they have places to practice, and you can go there and work on your concerto uninterrupted. And that is exactly what he did. He came and wrote a large quantity of the score and orchestrated it in one of our practice cabins. As I grew up here, we actually always called them practice shacks. Now they're cabins because they have air conditioning and electric light and doors that open and windows that close. In those days they did not. And there was a joyful cacophony up in the practice village because everybody was singing and playing at the top of their lungs all at the same time. And it was just an extraordinary way to make music. In a way, it was the jangled nerves kind of music that was happening in the New York scene. And also in Europe, where jazz, especially in France, was considered an original American art form with its roots in African-American music and in the black spirituals, which we had been hearing here at Chautauqua, again, as Marley said, from before the turn of the 19th into the 20th century as a regular thing. So this was a great place for George Gershwin to come. He finished the concerto, played the very first performance of it on two pianos in the teaching studio in the front corner of Sherwood Studio. Since Sherwood's been remodeled, that studio is now folded into the new concert space up there. I have a wonderful picture in my archives of George Gershwin sitting under a tree that used to grow right outside of that studio. It's the same tree that I sat under when I was 15 years old and trying to decide whether I wanted to go into music or to go do something else that was possibly more lucrative, like law or medicine. And one of my teachers, Patricia Bankman Marsh, sat me under that tree, and she said, "If you can imagine living the rest of your life without being intimately involved in music every single day, then go do something else. And that's what made up my mind. That's the tree under which Gershwin was sitting, grinning because he had just finished the concerto in F. It was later played in the center concert room at Sherwood Studio for all of the piano students that were here. And I'm not sure they knew exactly what they were hearing. We have 2020 hindsight, so we see that as a landmark work in 20th century American music and in 20th century pianism. But for people at the time, it was kind of quaint, and it's, oh, that's that young man Gershwin. He's the one who's such a good cook and does those wonderful parts. So let me play a little bit of Gershwin for you. These are two of the three preludes for piano that he published. He had in mind, we think now, to write 24 of these, one in each of the major and minor keys. This was not a unique idea. Chopin had done it. Dmitri Shostakovich was doing it at that same time in music history. Johann Sebastian Bach had done it twice. He'd written two sets of the 24. Bach did it as a party trick to prove that if you tuned your keyboard in a certain way, you could play things in every single key and nobody would wince when you got to what were called the wolf keys, E flat minor and F sharp major. So it's an irresistible target, and Gershwin was apparently intending to do this, but got too busy to actually write them down. Six other of these preludes are floating around as quick sketches. I heard from a couple of years ago from a man from Buffalo who said that he studied with a very ancient and eccentric piano teacher in Buffalo who supposedly had all 24 of these preludes sitting in a heap next to his piano, that he thought someday I'll get around to publishing these for Mr. Gershwin, but that apparently never happened. Of the three, this is the first one, very familiar, and then the second one, which Gershwin entitled Blues Lullaby. This was floating around in Chautauqua in the 1930s.
Thank you.
big sort of honky-tonk sound. All was not wonderfully tuned Steinways here at Chautauqua in those days, but the music making was extraordinary nevertheless. And as my beloved teacher, Ozan Marsh here, used to say, "Mr. Jacobson, are you playing A piano or B piano?"
Thank you.
becomes confusing. Depending on the elements of the biblical story,